This evening's talk is about compassion, which is the second of the divine abidings, the second of the Brahmaviharas. It's the heartbeat of the Buddha's teaching. And beginning with some words from American author and photographer Eudora Welty. My continuing passion is to part a curtain, that invisible veil of indifference that falls between us and that blinds us to each other's presence, each other's wonder, and each other's human plight. There's an image in Tibetan Buddhism that represents the awakened energy of unconditional, boundless compassion. It's an image of a bodhisattva that's often depicted as having 1,000 arms outstretched and 1,000 eyes, an eye painted in the palm of each hand that's reaching out. 1,000 eyes to see all of the suffering in the world, and 1,000 arms reaching out to help. A number of years ago, I attended a retreat with a Vietnamese monk and venerable teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. And there were about 400 adults and about 30 children at this retreat. The children were off each day having their own retreat, but each morning they would come in to do a kind of show and tell for all of the adults before we began our retreat day. And so each morning they would stand up in front of us and in various ways shared with us what they'd been doing and learning during the previous day. One morning all 30 of the children came into the meditation tent and they stood in a long line silently facing the 400 adults. And then each child stretched out both their arms wide open with their hands facing us. In the palm of each child's hand, there was an eye painted. And then one little boy walked up onto the platform where the Venerable Thich Nhat Hanh was sitting and painted an eye in the palm of one of Thay's hands. That was their whole presentation that morning. No words, just that. Very touching, very inspiring, and very beautiful. So, compassion, karuna in Pali. What is it experientially? About 50 years ago, early one June morning, I heard the wake-up stirrings of one of my newly born twin sons. Holding him that morning with a very sweet tenderness between us, as he lay open-eyed and relaxed and quite contented, and my eyes looking very deeply into his face with a kind of wonderment and a curiosity. And then I suddenly felt my heart tremble, quiver, the vibration permeating my chest and heart center, and then moving through my whole body and in through my mind. A feeling of connection, an intimacy with him and with life as a force, so to say. Immediately interwoven with these moments was a deep sense that this tiny new being would experience many difficult things in his life, difficult situations and many painful bodily and mental experiences within himself. And a wave of the breadth of the suffering in life literally quivered through me in the midst of those moments of sweetness and beauty that morning. And some tears came, but not the aching tears of the sadness that can come with feelings of attachment. That morning, the tears were really the juice of compassion. That yes, this is how it is for all of us, and for him as well. That morning's experience has returned many, many times, and in many ways, as both a teaching and a practice for me, within the enormous gratitude that living life immersed in the Dhamma brings. The Buddha described compassion as the trembling, the quivering of the heart in response to pain, in response to suffering, ours or that of another being. And as I said at the beginning of the talk, compassion is the heartbeat of the Buddha's teaching. It's one of the two wings with which we learn to fly free. The wing of wisdom, of deeply understanding the not-self nature of all things, and the wing of compassion, the heart's connection to beings that comes through a very deep understanding of dukkha, the cycle of unsatisfactoriness that runs through most of our lives, knowing its cause and knowing the way of its end. Because meditation practice has the power to clear away, to purify mental obscurations, the states of mind that constrict, that bind the heart, that bind the mind, practice actually makes us more keenly aware, more keenly aware of, and more sensitive to the suffering in this world. How can we bring our deepening sensitivity, our new awareness of dukkha into our practice, into this path of liberation? Our practice really must be grounded in the non-judgmental acceptance that the heart of metta offers us. It's also grounded in concentration, mindfulness, and investigation, meaning a clear, focused mindfulness and the discrimination of states of heart and mind and body, connecting with what arises and seeing it clearly. A mind, a heart that's steeped in metta is what allows for the connection of mindfulness to take place in relationship to whatever arises. The blossoming of this important capacity along our way in this training is intimately involved with our growing capacity to compassionately meet and clearly see the difficult, to compassionately and wisely understand the suffering that shows up in life. Compassion is a very tender, very open state, and at the same time, a place within us that is of great strength. Tenderness, openness, and strength. The capacity to stay present in relationship to whatever's happening within our own body-mind continuum and in relationship to what's going on around us, and not feel overwhelmed by any of it. And so we gently practice maintaining our awareness of suffering when it shows up in our field of experience. Most of us are strongly conditioned to sweep discomfort, to sweep dis-ease under the rug, to hide it away in the metaphoric closet or attic. Or we hide ourself away by shutting off, by maybe going to sleep, by distracting ourselves, or possibly through ignoring or maybe trivializing suffering, so that we don't see or feel the pain of others in this world, so that we don't see and feel our own pain, our own suffering. Our conditioned habits of avoidance and distraction are all based in fear. The fear that if we really recognize, connect with, and open to the pain, that it will touch in too deeply and cause us more discomfort, anguish, maybe unbearable pain. The aim of compassion, of karuna practice, is to move towards turning the developing capacity for heartful, unconditional acceptance, which is metta, to gently turn the heart, the mind, specifically towards suffering in relationship to ourself or in relationship to others. And then with understanding and with courage, open to and move towards the alleviation of suffering. Through the purification of the mind, the heart, that practice affords us, over time we really do learn to do this without getting overwhelmed by the suffering, but rather to begin to feel and know an unobstructed strength of understanding and care and courage, which is what gives us the necessary and wholesome energy to act. In cultivating the heart of metta and karuna, along with the discipline of developing concentration and mindfulness and investigation, a whole new realm of choices, insights, and responses become available to us. We meet and accept, which is really the essence of mindfulness based in metta. And then in whatever ways might be appropriate, we're able to help. And we're able to help without any aspect of aversion creating a barrier. True compassion, or boundless compassion, as it's often called, is when we have the capacity to open our heart to the suffering of all beings, ourself included, and in our mind not make others or ourself more important than each other. Compassion is neither strained nor is it reactive. It flows from the heart with the capacity to transform the fear, the anger, the judgments, the resentment, disappointment, grief, or expectations that might be present in relationship to another or in relationship to our own bodily and mental experiences. With the development and the blossoming of compassion, we're cultivating an immeasurable impartiality, which the Tibetan Buddhist teacher Chogyam Trungpa described as a pure and fearless openness without territorial limitation. Compassion has the power to melt, to dissolve the separation between self and other. To dissolve this separation in the direct experience of our body, heart, and mind, in an open-hearted and yet impersonal, non-self-identified way. It's our clinging to the idea of self, our deeply habituated thought of a separate, solid, static self that perpetuates this painful separation, or as it's sometimes called, the duality. Compassion has the power to dissolve and counteract the uneasiness, the discomfort, the contraction, or the withdrawal in the face of others or our own pain and suffering, so that we're honestly and truly present with them and with ourself. How different this is from the reactive patterns of anger and fear and resentment and judgment and unhealthy grief or jealousy or greed. I think most of us usually think of mental states, emotional states, particularly, as being positive or negative. As understanding deepens through our practice, we begin to know that most important and helpful and the true way of seeing and knowing mental states is the differentiation between reaction and response. Reaction, or if we break that word down in English, reaction, is always based on the past, on past conditioned patterns that are rooted in an agenda. Patterns and agendas that are always primarily associated with I, me, or mine. So consequently, they aren't connected to, don't really see, don't really serve the whole reality of our present moment experience. Reaction always supports and recreates some aspect of our particular karmic predicament. It reifies our habitual thoughts, actions, and self-identification as, this is who I am, this is who you are. Compassion, on the other hand, is a response, not a reaction. There's a story about Zen Master Ryokan, whose brother invited him to visit his house and to speak with his delinquent son. Ryokan went, of course, but didn't say any words of admonishment to the boy while he was there. He stayed overnight, and he prepared to leave early the next morning. And as his wayward nephew was sitting on the ground helping Ryokan lace up his straw sandals, the boy felt a drop of warm water touch his hand. And as he glanced up, he saw his uncle Ryokan looking down at him with his eyes full of tears. Ryokan returned home, and the nephew, he was told soon after his visit, changed for the better. Compassion training, the practice and the unfolding of karuna, is challenging. It's often difficult. If we take the heart of the Buddha's words, if we take to heart the Buddha's words, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. And as we all know by now, the Buddha wasn't about to go on and to tell us the best way to suffer. We're all quite well practiced in this. And he wasn't recommending suffering. He was, though, pointing out that unsatisfactoriness, confusion, anguish are all intrinsic to our human condition. Or more accurately, that these states of mind are intrinsic until we wake up to the true nature of life. What he was pointing out was the truth of its existence, the existence of dukkha. And that looking directly, deeply, and honestly at the reality of suffering in our lives is what leads us to take the necessary steps to free ourselves from it, which in turn leads to a transformation and relinquishment of the mental states that cause us so much anguish and often so much confusion. Trying to control, trying to cling on to or push away or avoid events or any moments of this constantly changing life, with the nature of it all really being uncontrollable, ungovernable, ungraspable, will inevitably bring suffering. It's our relationship to phenomena that brings the suffering that the Buddha speaks about being free from. I found it amazing and illuminating when I began to see that as I practiced, the particular objects that come into awareness, they really don't change much. Basically, we keep attending to the same body-mind objects. It's how we experience and see and know particular objects. It's our relationship to them that changes. Very important. And so we find out something really kind of astonishing and fortunate about suffering. That it itself is a conditional, totally contingent aspect of life, not an absolute. As we begin to see more clearly, and as we continue to climb the mountain of metta, compassion, and wisdom, letting the heavy rock of our unskillful and yet cherished habits and identities roll to the bottom, we're less and less often habitually, blindly caught and trapped in old patterns of a suffering relationship to life. The capacities of kindness, compassion, mindful awareness, concentration, and wisdom begin to really take root and grow. Our heart opens, and we're really, truly beginning to awaken. A while ago, I received a letter from a very dear friend of mine, and I'd like to share part of it with you. Just had an insight about compassion recently. You might know my niece has been living with me for the past year. I've had lots of conflicting emotions about this, resenting it, irritated, wanting her to leave, but something holding me back from actually telling her that. I recently realized it's compassion. Compassion for a kind of young, wounded soul that I'm following through on. Compassion, I think, is bound up with integrity. I realize that if I let all of my conflicting feelings and issues take over, I would be compromising my integrity, my understanding and belief about the importance of compassion. Sometimes acting with compassion is hard work because it requires us to let go of limiting behaviors. So I'm still feeling some of these things, but feel very clear about my course of action. Life can be so rich and challenging in all of its connections to friends, parents, and children, she said. So where does the heart's capacity for compassion and our inclination to cultivate compassion, where does it come from? The seeds of compassion within us have been planted many times. Every time we experienced another being who was willing to be with us when we were in pain, Every time we've been cared for or attended to or listened to or just simply sat with, when we've been sick or hurting physically or when we've been in some emotional pain, the seeds of compassion were sown. In any moment of a purely compassionate connection, relationship is transformed by cutting through the me-you, subject-object dualism. Karuna is a unifying energy. The giver and the receiver are joined, not separate, in any moment of pure presence. These moments hold and carry a particular energy of the heart, the particular energy of compassion. And then they plant the seeds of this energy in the receiver. And for most of us, this happens many, many times throughout our life. And so we have many seeds to cultivate through our practice. And of course, we in turn plant many seeds. Every time we remain present with another being who's suffering, who's in pain physically or emotionally, a seed of compassion is planted. And the seed of Karuna within our own heart is watered and it's fertilized and it grows. Every time we wholesomely respond rather than react, both internally and outwardly to a difficult or painful set of circumstances, a seed of compassion is planted, and the seeds of Karuna within our own heart grow. And sometimes the learning curve can be very, very steep. The emotional or physical pain facing us from another or within ourselves asks us to step into what might be unknown territory and into an unfettered, compassionate relationship. And this can take us to the very core of our being, the very core of our subtle, self-centered agenda, the agenda that props up the veil of subtle or maybe not so subtle separation, duality that we've been living behind, maybe forever. These learning curves that come our way every once in a while hold the possibility for us to recognize and let go of the habitual knots that bind us, which in turn then offers us the really, truly amazing possibility of an unfettered, compassionate connection with another and with ourself as well. So looking at it this way, the interaction within every relationship has the potential of planting a seed for the arising of a clear and true presence within both beings. The interaction within every relationship has the potential of a transmission. And as I mentioned in relationship to Metta last week, it's kind of a circular process. We receive the seeds of compassion as a transmission, and we give the transmission to others and also, again, to ourselves through acts of compassion. And then on and on it goes, the spiraling transmission of Karuna. For me and for many people, an amazing and inspiring contemporary embodiment and transmitter of compassion has been Mother Teresa. In a video about her life and her work, there's a short scene where she stops by the bed of a man who had just been brought in from the street and who's extremely emaciated and sick. And she gets down on the floor He's just on a pallet on the floor, and she gets down on the floor very close to him and looks directly into his eyes. And then just simply lays her hand over his heart. And he looks directly back at her. And for those few moments, the appearance of the enormous suffering in his face changes. It changes completely into light and love. A few moments of a gentle and very powerful transmission. With the heart of compassion, there's a great strength and trust in our ability to bear witness and face whatever it is, to be with what is, without wanting to make it disappear, without ignoring it or repressing it, or pretending that something else is happening. Aversion to pain, ours or another's, says, I can't stand this. I can't be near it. I can't bear this feeling. And it's so important when this comes up in the mind, when this comes up in the heart, it's so important to connect to the aversion, to the fear, to be mindful with it, with mindful awareness that's based in a non-judgmental connection and acceptance of metta. Meeting the reactive state of mind, meeting the reactive pattern that's arising with open-hearted mindfulness. This is the attention that connects. This is how it is right now. This is fear, this is grief, this is judgment, this is anger. This is what's appearing in this moment, and this is how it is. It's so very important to recognize our limits without self-judgment, however they might show up in the process of the cultivation of compassion. Karuna is never developed by force. It's appropriate and natural to back off from painful experience at times in our practice and in our life as a whole. Kindness and gentleness with ourself is an important and necessary aspect of our practice. This is metta and Karuna itself. And in relationship to this, I'd like to share a piece from a book called An Interrupted Life, which is a diary written between 1941 and that was written between 1941 and 1943. By a woman named Etty Hillesum. Etty was a 27-year-old Dutch-Jewish woman who, in the midst of the Second World War, lived in a large house with a group of people in Amsterdam, and then, in very bad health, lived in Westerbork concentration camp, and then briefly lived in Auschwitz, where she was exterminated on November 30th in 1943. Amazing, these years of great suffering throughout Europe were for Etty a time of enormous personal growth and, paradoxically enough, a time of personal liberation. In the midst of the scenario of extermination that was being played out all over Europe, Etty, we could say, wrote the counter scenario. Her diary is quite an amazing account of our possibility as human beings in the midst of extreme, immense difficulty. And this is from her diary. I think I'll do it anyway. I'll turn inward for half an hour each morning before work and listen to my inner voice. Lose myself. You could call it meditation. I'm still a bit wary of that word, but anyway, why not? A quiet half hour within yourself, but it's not so simple, the sort of quiet hour. It has to be learned. A lot of unimportant inner litter and bits of pieces have to be swept out first. Even a small head can be piled high inside with irrelevant distractions. So let this be the aim of meditation, to turn one's innermost being into a vast, empty space with none of that treacherous undergrowth to impede the view, so that something of God can enter you and something of love too. Not the kind of love deluxe that you revel in deliciously for half an hour, taking pride in how sublime you feel, but the love you can apply to small, everyday things. And at another point in her diary, Eddie wrote, "Mysticism must rest on crystal clear honesty and can only come after things have been stripped down to their naked reality." Eddie, with her clear vision, instinctively knew that she wouldn't return from the camps. And she asked a friend to keep her diaries. She knew that she wanted to leave some trace behind to share the solutions that she'd found for her own life. And from the last entry in her diary, "Ever since last night, I've been lying here trying to assimilate just a little of the terrible suffering that has to be endured all over the world, to accommodate just a little of the great sorrow the coming of winter has in store. It could not be done. Today will be a hard day. I shall lie quietly and try to anticipate something of the days that are to come. When I suffer for the vulnerable, is it not for my own vulnerability that I really suffer?" And she ends her diary with, "We should be willing to act as a balm for all wounds." Survivors from the camp have confirmed that Eddie was a luminous and compassionate personality to the very last. It's important to stay mindful in the moving away from and the coming close to, the opening to and the withdrawal that happens in relationship to the mental, physical, or situational pain that's showing up. As it is with any object that we give a heartful, mindful attention to in our practice, our perception of the object will change as we see it more and more clearly. And consequently, then, our relationship to the object will also change. We need to learn to befriend ourselves, to come close and see how it is, to see how it really is. It might be a very strong and intense energy, but it's not at all static, nor is it solid. We can come so close with the great intimacy of our practice to see how it really is. Can we come so close, grounded in the heart connection of acceptance, of metta, and with a growing compassion, and see the various colors of the rainbow of our experience really, truly in themselves, and begin to see through these colors, even the strongest of the colors. If a very dear friend comes to you with their troubles, I mean, usually we give them our attention, and we give them our care in some way. We don't usually tell them to stop feeling what they're feeling or tell them to get away from us in the midst of their suffering. Our practice teaches us how to befriend ourselves, which quite naturally leads to the development and blossoming of a connection with all beings. We come to really know that the pain in our heart or the pain in our back essentially isn't different than the pain in the heart or the back of any being anywhere in this world. For most of us, our hand quite naturally and quite spontaneously often reaches out to soothe the ache maybe in our foot or our back or our heart. What is it that sometimes holds us back from spontaneously responding to the suffering of another in this very same simple and natural way? Essentially, this is due to a deeply conditioned and almost visceral clinging to the idea of being a separate self. As long as we're immersed and blindly living in and out of this fixed idea, spontaneous concern for others will primarily be felt for those who fall into the range of who we think of as mine. And there may be some degree of indifference or maybe even a more overt aversion in relationship to the pain of those who are outside of this range of mine. And this range can be a broad range of mine, not just our relatives or our dear friends, but maybe mine culturally or mine neighborhood, or it can be a bigger mine than just a few people. But it's mine in our mind. As our heart opens and as our understanding deepens, there's an easing of the constrictive feelings and constrictive thoughts based in self-centeredness. As our heart opens and understanding grows, connection and empathy blossom. And our sense of being in a closed cell begins to dissolve. It's not that I or me vanishes into some bottomless hole of nothingness. Instead, we discover, in fact, that we're truly and simply a cell that forms part of, and to quote Stephen Batchelor, the interdependent, multicellular organism of existence itself. As wisdom blossoms, our way of being in and with conventional reality is transformed. We come to know experientially that I, this sense of I, only exists in relationship to you. I and me isn't eliminated. Me is transformed. There's only relationship. I, me, you, them, us, etc., have never and will never exist in isolation, have never and will never exist in any solid, static, separate way. The notions of me and you, the seemingly fixed conceptual distinctions of me and you, begin to dissolve with the blossoming of unconditional acceptance, metta, and karuna, compassion, and in relationship to the way that we go about our life, how we relate in this life. Spontaneous, empathetic response begins to emerge really quite naturally, more and more often. And we begin to understand in ourselves, so to say, that the needs of I and me are no more important than those of you. This is really the birth of unconditional kindness and compassion. And some words from regarding this from Shantideva, the 8th century Buddhist monk. I should dispel the pain of others because it hurts like my own, and I should be good to them because they feel just as I do. When both they and I are the same in wanting joy and not desiring pain, what's so special about me? When I act for the sake of others, no amazement or conceit arises. Just like feeding myself, I hope for nothing in return. And yet, as we know, it's not so easy, this relating to others and to ourself with the clarity of a pure, compassionate heart, as we have many old and seemingly new personal agendas. We have many deeply conditioned habitual patterns. I think that for many people there's some confusion in relationship to the difference between pity and what can be described as an unhealthy grief and compassion. Both of these energies, pity and grief, are what are called the near enemy, or what look like, or what masquerade as compassion. Pity actually touches pain with fear instead of mercy, instead of a really true, open-hearted, caring presence. Pity is a subtle form of aversion. It manifests as some degree of contraction away from, a withdrawal, if we look really, really carefully. When we pity, there's a subtle, or maybe not so subtle, wanting it to be different. And also maybe some feeling that I'm glad it's not me that's suffering so much. A tinge, maybe a flavor of arrogance that's a cover-up for our fear and our inability at that particular moment to be with the suffering that we're encountering. The energy of unhealthy or unwholesome, the unwholesome component, we could say, of grief is fraught with self-centeredness. Unhealthy or unwholesome grief is a very self-obsessed energy, and it could lead one into depression if it goes unrecognized. One can get caught and lost in the downward spiral of this strong and deep contraction, which if we clearly see it, we find that it's a fixation on the idea of a separate, solid me and you. This fixation can often be quite a strong component in the midst of an unrecognized, unhealthy grief. When we feel pity in ourself for ourself, or when we're caught in the self-obsession of unhealthy grief, in those moments we're actually not experiencing any true caring or kindness or compassion for ourselves, but rather we're caught in a kind of sticky, sinking feeling, that heavy ache of feeling sorry for ourselves, that poor me with a capital M-E. And in this place, there's really not much, if any, capacity to act towards taking care of ourselves. So again, within the natural spaciousness of a non-judgmental, mindful awareness rooted in metta, can we practice acknowledging and coming close to our experiences of body and mind? letting go of relating to experience through the veil of concept, through the veil of identification, myself as a pitiable, pitiful person. But rather the possibility of, well, here's pity. Here's grief. This is what's arising. It's not me, it's not mine, it's not who I am, but it's coming up. How is it? Metta, mindfulness, and compassion are necessary companions on this path to awakening. And in this seeming magic that can happen when they work together. We might be surprised at any moment by the arising of compassion in what might feel like a most unlikely circumstance. Compassion arising in a most unexpected moment and in a most maybe unexpected way. I'd like to share a piece from my diary that comes from my participation in the first Bearing Witness retreat that Roshi Bernie Glassman held in Poland in November of 1996 at the Auschwitz concentration camp. It's well into the second month of offering the Buddha Dhamma here in Poland. Tomorrow begins a few days away from my teaching duties. I'll take a train and go to the remains of the concentration camp at Auschwitz. It's American Thanksgiving. Bernie Glassman has organized the first Bearing Witness retreat. As we slowly walk through the camp on this first harsh gray November morning, I'm aware of two distinct qualities of energy that seem to permeate the atmosphere, the land, the buildings, imbuing every aspect of Auschwitz that we come into contact with. The first of these is an enormous depth of sadness, an incredible heaviness and heartache that's palpable. It's everywhere, in and emanating from everything. It brings tears from the eyes of many of the 140 people attending this retreat. The stacked bunks and open sewer living spaces of the so-called prisoners. The shocking photos of children and displays of their shoes, clothes, and toys touch my heart to a depth almost too much to hold. The other quality of energy is amorphous, yet also palpable. It's in the atmosphere and at moments in my body and heart. It manifests like waves of razor-sharp edginess and tension, moments of touching what feels like insanity. This is even harder to let fully in than the immense sadness, as it's a far less familiar feeling and thus much less comfortable. There's a sense of not wanting to get too close to whatever this is. The sorrow and the heartache are immediately understandable to me, but I'm not so easily comprehending the atmospheric, almost terrifying tension, the raw discordance and alienation, until one afternoon I find myself alone on my knees in front of an oven where the bodies of those murdered by the Nazis were burned. Tears stream from my eyes, and Om Mani Padme Hum, the Tibetan mantra of compassion, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, spontaneously repeats out loud from my heart for the Nazis. A deep intuitive understanding of utter insanity and the untenable suffering therein is fathomed. The depth of disconnection, separation from life, from oneself, the unmitigated alienation that one would have to be living in, living with, in order to murder one, let alone millions, is recognized. And my heart cracks open with this recognition. In the midst of this unforeseen insight, my whole being is flooded with unconditional compassion. Not for the actions of the Nazis, but for the actors. Since that Thanksgiving retreat, I've been deeply aware that just as each of us has the capacity to help others from the heart of compassion, each one of us also knows at least moments of disconnection, separation from life, from ourself, and the unmitigated alienation and utter insanity, untenable suffering therein. I know now so much more clearly that if one identifies with this experience as I, me, mine, and mires into this self-identification, this place of great existential suffering, it can lead to outward actions that in turn cause suffering for others, as happened to such an extreme degree in Auschwitz. Since the days at Auschwitz, I'm feeling enormous gratitude that somehow all of the opportunities and blessings have been in place for me to connect with these teachings and practices, which are the best medicine for all wounds. A couple of years after I returned from Poland, this story was put into a newsletter that the Taos Mountain Sangha Meditation Group sent out. And I'd like to share a response that I received from an Israeli Dhamma student, a woman who has been quite involved in Israeli-Palestinian peace initiative work off and on over the years. And this is from her. Thank you for the newsletter you sent me. I would like to ask your permission to translate your article about compassion to Hebrew for the Sangha here. We seem to need to be reminded of this quality, especially now when we are facing such difficult times. I was deeply touched reading your diary about the compassion you expressed for the Nazis. It was very hard for me to understand. From my early childhood, I saw the horror and the pain on the faces of people who survived and were the parents or grandparents of friends of mine. They and other people told us every year stories from what they have experienced. I felt as if they wanted us to carry the horror with us forever. I remember once I took a train from Copenhagen to Amsterdam and was not aware of the fact that the train has to go through Germany. I went to sleep and was awakened when the train stopped at the border and a German policeman came and asked for my passport. I was never so terrified. I felt all the blood in my veins froze. After a while, I fell asleep again and I had a dream. In my dream, the train had stopped and the policeman asked everybody to step down from the train. I refused, saying again and again, "I'm not allowed to tread on German soil." Finally, I took some books that were in my bag and put them on the ground and very carefully made my way. Then I woke up from the dream, woke up from sleep. I think only then I realized how deeply I was influenced by the stories I heard as a child. I cannot even bear the thought of going to Poland. I am too frightened to even think about it. From this state of mind, I tried to connect with what you experienced. I felt it very important for me to be able to make such a transition. A few days later, I watched on TV a regular video that Hamas is broadcasting after each terrorist act. A young man with guns in both his hands, a flag, and the book of the Quran explained that he's ready to give up his life and kill as many Israelis as possible. His eyes were empty. Life, his, others, any life, had no meaning for him. I began to cry. Then I thought, maybe this was the unconditional compassion you were expressing. I could connect to this now. And then she ends her note to me. I wanted to share this with you, and again, to thank you. And some words from Vimala Thakur, the Indian spiritual master, she's no longer alive, who was a longtime student of Krishnamurti's. She's been described as embodying the essence of enlightened consciousness and social responsibility. And these are her words. We're at odds with ourselves internally. We believe that the inner is fundamentally different from the outer, that what is me is quite separate from the not me, that division among people and nations are necessary, and yet we wonder why there are tensions, conflicts, wars in the world. The conflicts begin with minds that believe in fragmentation and are ignorant of wholeness. When we come face to face with the actualities of human and planetary suffering, what does this powerful moment of truth do to us? Do we retreat into the comforts of theories and defense mechanisms, or are we awakened at the core of our being? In one of his discourses, in one of the Buddha's discourses, we find him with a small group of bhikkhus, small group of monks, sharing with them what his thoughts were soon after his awakening. And I always find it quite interesting and helpful and inspiring to read the Buddha's words about himself, his speaking about his own humanness, which he even spoke about in relationship to his process of awakening. In reflecting on the lineage of these amazing teachings that we've inherited down through the centuries from our teachers and their teachers and their teachers' teachers, all the way back to the Buddha, this heartfelt wisdom lineage of the extended Dhamma family, if it wasn't for the wing of the Buddha's compassion, we wouldn't have these teachings available to us today. And so these are the Buddha's words that he's sharing with his bhikkhus, what his thoughts were soon after his awakening. This Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in worldliness, takes delight in worldliness, rejoices in worldliness. It's hard for such a generation to see this truth. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Enough with teaching the Dhamma that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate. Those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, subtle, deep, and difficult to see. And then the Buddha goes on to say, considering thus, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. And he then tells his monks that soon after this, a certain Brahmin came to him and pleaded. The Brahmin said, "The world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata," which is a term that was used for the Buddha after he was enlightened, "since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma." And then the Buddha goes on speaking with his monks. "Then I listened to the Brahmin's pleading, and out of compassion for beings, I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying such, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good and with bad qualities. I saw beings easy to teach and hard to teach. And then I replied to the Brahma, 'Out of compassion for beings, open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith.' Thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahman, I did not speak the Dhamma, subtle and sublime." And so this wing of unconditional compassion, profound and subtle, in itself, obviously not so easy to reach in its fullness and purity. Karuna, so honestly and clearly spoken about in the Buddha's description of his own awakening. It's the wing that connects the absolute understanding of not-self to the relative nature of our humanness. One way to look at this that I think may be helpful in understanding it is this. To know not-self means to know directly and clearly that life is only in the immediate presence of just what is being experienced. To know compassion means that we fully attend to what arises in experience, because it's all that we know and can ever really, truly know. And I'd like to close the talk this evening with a small piece from a man who was a very, very dedicated Dhamma practitioner here in Taos, who died of AIDS-related complications a number of years ago. And this is a piece from his unfinished book. He never lived long enough to finish his book. My first 8-day Vipassana retreat. Trepidation and desire fill my soul in equal measure. Will I encounter deeply buried demons from my past? Will emotions overwhelm me? Will I be able to stop crying? In the days leading up to the retreat, it's as if my body is attempting to erode the quiet resolve of my mind to go. Pain gathers in my back, making my daily sit uncomfortable. Unaccountably, my gums start to throb and bleed. My left leg grows numb. On the day I make the 2-hour drive to the retreat center, a splitting headache rips through my brain, bringing me to tears. "I don't care what you do," I say out loud to my body. "I'm going to that retreat." The retreat schedule looks daunting, from 5:45 in the morning till 10 at night. 9 sits alternate with 8 walks for 6 days. 2 half days are also full. Meals are deliciously vegetarian. The air is abuzz with insects feasting on the nectar of hundreds of flowers around the center. Before we take up our vows of silence, I tell one of the two teachers that I may need to nap during the day, and I'm reassured by the gentle understanding that I receive. Participate when you can. Rest when you need to. By our first sit, all of my bodily pain is gone. Blessed silence and avoiding eye contact with others enables me to develop a cocoon of self. By the second full day, I marvel that I'm attending all of the sessions without the need for naps. I begin to feel energized and even find time to incorporate the Hatha Yoga series I learned years ago into the schedule. I sense new levels of awareness about the nature of this practice, about the Buddha's compassion. During one Dhamma talk, we're asked to consider what a nightmare life would be if there were no change. By the fourth day, questions during Dhamma talks increase in intensity. Are metta and karuna better than vipassana? Is holding onto the breath different than holding a thought? If we can observe our thoughts rising and falling, where do they come from? Where do they go? We're creating an energy of trust. My heart opens to all retreatants struggling their own struggles. Who am I to judge anyone? They are me. The rhythm of the retreat mimics the rhythm of our breath and the rhythm of nature. All around us, cycles come and go, repeat and fall away. AIDS is a cycle. It's not my condition, but the human condition. It's the great gift that has taught me about impermanence. I realize how vipassana-like AIDS has been in my life, always bringing me back to the now, always reminding me to be present. And vipassana practice is a cycle. It's in my life and out. It touches everything I do and is nowhere. The last full day of the retreat, during a walking meditation, I was overwhelmed with sadness for all humanity and for the planet. I cried and cried in pain. How can there ever be an end to suffering? And then I stopped and looked up at the hill behind the meditation center. My heart as though leaping open for a moment into the beauty of this life. The suffering and the beauty, all of it being held, but not held onto. And let's sit for just a moment.